So, Richard, I have a controversial theory on Neelix.
Okay.
That I would like to share with you and the listeners that I just came up with a few minutes ago.
I am ready.
Based on the fact that Neelix was in neither of these week's episodes.
I was about to say.
I think Neelix is the Jake Sisko of Star Trek Voyager.
Oh. Okay, so he becomes a writer at the end and it might all be his story?
Yeah. Think about it. He is missing from a large portion of episodes. Episodes that he is in, he's in like one scene, and he wears very colorful, strange clothing.
You know, and the captain does have a kind of amused, you know, obviously Sisko, you know, is amused by Jake as and proud of Jake as his son, and Janeway is kind of a, aw, shucks, that's the kid, you know, kind of to Neelix. It's true.
Yeah, I think Neelix is her son.
That's great.
Which is actually revealed in the sixth season of the show.
So her son with the dude from the first episode with the dog.
Yep.
Interesting. So the dog explains his hair.
Exactly. So State of Flux.
This was a fantastic episode. This was a very nuanced episode which takes the political situation of where they're in very seriously. It takes the Cardassian view of how a Cardassian would view the situation in a way which bears out things which would develop in later seasons of DS9. This is a episode which very much understands the characters in the world and all of the different factions, and it makes the next episode that much the worse.
We'll talk about Heroes and Demons in a few minutes, but I agree with you. I like State of Flux quite a bit, and I think that, you know, this episode coming right on the heels of Prime Factors from last week.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say that I don't know, it's hard to say that Voyager's first season is on a whole, I think, hanging together very well. I think it is very tonally weird in a lot of places, and they haven't quite figured out the characters in a kind of a similar fashion, I think, to actually the first and second seasons of TNG. You know, if you think back to the characters in the first season of TNG, they were all over the place, and they didn't really come into their own for a couple of years. The characters are coming into a sort of focus, I think, at least some of them. You know, I would say Kes is pretty strongly sketched out at this point. I think the Doctor is coming into his own. Janeway is. Certain other characters are not. I think that they don't know what to do with Paris. I think they don't really know what to do with Chakotay.
They try, and you do get some. Certainly, I think this is probably the first episode we would call a Chakotay episode, and it acquits him very well. Sesko, who is a minor character, and at least in this episode, which is focusing on her, it has a very good idea of who she is. Now, of course, you're right. This is much more of a one-off of her than...
Yeah, but I think it works because we I mean, you even mentioned her. You even have noticed her. I mean, she's been in, I think, three or four episodes before this. She was in the second episode of the show, Parallax.
Yeah.
Being the, hey, if we want to take the ship, we'll do it with you, Chakotay. So, well,
we
established
her.
It established her as a character which was perhaps not excited to be there. And I don't know that I would say this is a logical conclusion to her story, but I think that it's a interesting one, and it's shocking.
She is certainly somebody who doesn't really like following the rules, but I think we're fooled by how open she has been this entire time. For example, you know, Seska doesn't really want to follow Federation procedure, but what does she want to do? She wants to get her people in charge of the ship because she thinks that that's the, you know, the right way, and Chakotay is already sort of there anyway, and she just wants to make her boyfriend mushroom soup. Like, that's all Seska's gonna really do. And so I at least got fooled by figuring, all right, that's as far as she's going to go when she is really going that much further.
Yeah, because it's funny to me because the character of Seska, of course, you can read a lot into her. And you're right, like early on in the season, when the appearances that Seska has been in so far, I think the character was used quite effectively. And apparently the actress did not know that this was the direction they were going in.
That was one of my questions. Did they... She reminds me of two characters from DS9. First of all, the one who was working with O'Brien that turns out to be Kai Wynn's agent, who has an appearance beforehand as just a minor character, and then it turns out she's on the ship for... So I wasn't sure if they had created Seska to be... Again, she's going to work with the KPA Cardassian, working with the Kazon, and we'll have her, you know, we'll seed her a little bit.
As I understand it, they did not have that conception of the character in the first episode she appeared in. But that pretty quickly became the idea.
Sure.
And so,
and I guess,
which is strange, like, because Voyager and the timeline of how they wrote the show, pretty much, I think all of the episodes that we've seen so far were written before an episode was even filmed.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I think one of the reasons why Heroes and Demons is so bad is that Niran Shakar, who worked on TNG and knew that show very well and knew Star Trek very well and knew the characters very well, had no idea about what the characters were going to be like. And so Heroes and Demons comes across as this sort of flat, wet fart. But in terms of State of Flux, I think it works because they were able to say, okay, we've got this character of Seska. She was in Parallax, the second episode that you know, we filmed. We're going to put her in a couple other episodes. It would have made a lot more, because they did talk about, apparently, you know, just having it be a character.
And I certainly could see a version of the show which did that, and it could have even been, they wrote this and they said, oh, hey, well, we have this actress anyway. She's been in a couple. People might have recognized her, so why not?
And if this was TNG, I think they would have done that. And so, I mean, think about something like, you know, like Ensign Ro, for example, right? Where her last appearance in the show, she's a traitor, but, you know, that didn't seem very TNG because it didn't do that kind of stuff. It didn't bring characters back and then do a 180 on them like that. Whereas Voyager is, okay, well, this is what's happening. And it also, I think, nicely ties into, I don't know, there is a certain element to it, which is kind of like, all right, well, it's the 10th episode of the show, something like that, 9th episode of the show. We've already had a Romulan. Now we have a Cardassian appearing. It could feel like they are perhaps not as interested in the Delta Quadrant as they should be, considering that they came up with this premise and they created the show. This wasn't something that they sort of like found.
Yeah.
But I think that it works in this case because it grounds the Maquis stuff in a real place. And it also, I think, gives a little bit more context to Chakotay as a character as well.
I think in other ways it uses the Cardassian-ness very well, in that it's, we know what the Federation reaction to this situation. We have an idea what the Maquis reaction to the situation is, but this is giving us what would the Cardassian response to this situation, and which gives us a different nuance to the Cardassians. As I said, this gives some ideas of stuff that spins out in later seasons of DS9. For example, when the Cardassians in DS9 realize that they're probably going to be beaten by the Dominion, the bigger power in the galaxy, what do? Through Gul Dukat, they sign up. They're like, we're going to be best friends. You're going to take care of us, right, guy? Like, he's pretty... The Cardassians are pretty much Chris Christie, right? In this situation, Seska is a Cardassian, sees we are fucked, we are alone here completely. Kazon are the closest thing to power in this galaxy, and so, hey Kazon, what's up? You want food replicators? That is such a... obviously, that is not where they thought the plot of DS9 would have gone at this point, so I think it's fairly insightful that this is where the Cardassians are characterized here.
Yeah, because I think if you place this in a context, I mean, of course, this was the third season of DS9.
Yeah,
so the Cardassians had a little bit of character development as a race, as a people, as a species, whatever you want to call it, in TNG. And then, of course, they had, you know, 2.5 seasons of what DS9 had been doing with the Cardassians to kind of get that, you know, to kind of flavor Seska a little bit. And I think also it does make sense even that the Cardassians would have agents with the Maquis. I mean, of course, why wouldn't they? You know, the Federation and the Cardassians are the two sides that the Maquis are fighting against.
I
do wonder, though, I mean, not, you know, sort of like Seska as a person, Seska as a Cardassian, they never come right out and say she's a agent of the Obsidian Order. Like, I don't know exactly what she's supposed to be in terms of her role in the Cardassian Order, but that's a minor point.
Yeah, exactly. She could be anything, frankly. But my question actually about concurrence, where was Eddington in all of this?
I don't think he – well –
because she comes off almost like an Eddington character. Again, she is above suspicion for the exact opposite reasons. Eddington was such a company man that we didn't suspect him. She is so not a company man that we don't suspect her. You know, she and, for example, B'Elanna Torres. I don't think B'Elanna Torres will ever betray the Federation, but she is going to, because she is venting out all of her frustrations openly with it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she already did betray the Federation, let's not forget. I mean, she was a Maquis.
Well, fair enough.
She was the only person, apparently, on Chakotay's entire crew that was not a secret agent, apparently.
I know, so far.
We need to talk about Chakotay because I feel bad for the guy. But
yeah,
I think I feel bad for him for a number of reasons, but this episode in particular. You know, I don't know.
And Sisko makes that comment, why don't you go and talk to your animal friend or whatever. It's like,
Jesus, Sisko, fuck you. Yeah. Like, God. Cardassians, I'll tell you. No, I believe that Eddington was first appeared in the third season of DS9, so kind of around the same time.
Okay, so maybe they had the ideas of, that was more just a curiosity.
Yeah, and so I think that, I mean, I don't know, because certainly Seska has some resonances with Eddington, but not a ton, because you know she comes from a different place. She is not.
No, I'm just thinking about how Star Trek has handled characters who are later who seem to be on the up and up and have later turned out to be betraying everybody behind the backs. But
yeah. Well, I don't know, because I feel bad for Janeway too, because of course Janeway's having a bad week. You know, last week Tuvok went behind her back to try and make a secret deal with the hedonistic aliens. And now
it's
this
not
week,
incidental that, I guess, yeah.
Now this week she is basically not the cause, but indirectly she is causing a big, you know, intergalactic incident with the Kazon because of this whole thing with Seska. And, you know, I feel bad for Janeway. I feel bad for Chakotay. I don't feel bad for Seska necessarily because...
Yeah,
I don't know what exactly her plan was. You know, that's kind of the weird thing about it is that she obviously had this backup plan. You know, one of the reasons I like this episode is because it reveals that Seska had these sort of contingency plans. She was really good at this, at least to a large degree, until she got injured and got beamed up to sickbay without having a say in it because she was unconscious. That's the only reason she was found out. But it's almost as though, because I mean, I remember talking about the Cardassians with you back in DS9 and saying, well, basically they're competent Romulans. Yeah. And you really see that in this episode.
Oh, I mean, she's an amazing liar.
Yeah, she's an amazing liar. She's obviously very well trained. She's not a great Bajoran, but you cover that up by the fact that she was in the Maquis.
And specifically, she's a non-religious Bajoran, so you get the sense that, all right, she's jaded, she's kind of an asshole.
Well, she is and she isn't. I mean, I always wonder if her line, thank the prophets, in this episode is a mistake on her part, or...
I think it comes off as, oh, thank God, you know, people who are atheists will say thank God, you know. I
don't say that.
Well, I said people who are, I didn't say you.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably right. I mean, and I think that
line was just to remind us that she is Bajoran in a way.
Yeah, she doesn't wear the earring and those noses are hard to see in standard def. No, yeah, I think that's right. And I don't know, let's talk about Chakotay then, because I think that I find Chakotay's story here very, very interesting. I think that this is the first time that we kind of get a sense of who he is as a person, you know, aside from generic Native American man. And I find him to be a very, very depressing character.
I think Chakotay is somebody that would be very lovely to be friends with, but he is the kind of... He's almost like the manager who wants everybody to be his friend. Like, he really wants everybody to get along in a way. And, you know, we should follow the rules because that's the best way. And, you know, it bothers him that when somebody is having a problem or things like that. And so everybody who is less scrupulous than he is able to completely fool him. Again, he's half of the people on his ship are turned out to be working for somebody else because... Gee whiz, he's a really trusting, nice guy. You know, he's a person who, in a way, he's the negative view of the Federation that, well, they're so nice that they're naive. That DS9 has proven that the Federation is not that way, but I think Chakotay is that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, because what this episode kind of reveals to me is why or how Chakotay would have joined the Maquis. Because I see in this episode a person who is a little bit of a sad sack, a person who is not a great judge of character and is probably very disappointed by people on a regular basis because of that.
Yeah.
And so for this kind of person to join the Maquis and to leave the Federation and, you know, essentially be undergoing a war of terrorism against the Federation, I think it comes more from a place of being disappointed in the Federation because he didn't think that they would do that sort of thing. And he's disappointed in Seska because he didn't think she would do this sort of thing. And it also kind of makes me wonder if he was right to push B'Elanna Torres for chief engineer because he's not a great judge of character. Yeah. So how the hell does he, you know, and
well,
also
to
like,
be fair that, you know, Jane, he makes the suggestion and Janeway is the one who, I mean, I'm thinking of last week when, which ends with Janeway saying, you know, I'm the captain. It's my turn to make the decision. You bring these things to me. You bring your objections. You bring your quandaries or whatever. I mean, it turns out to be the right thing to ask Janeway to weigh, should we make this deal for the literature and all of that. So, frankly, Janeway is the failsafe against Chakotay's inabilities because she is a very good judge of character. I think, though, the issue would be was making... Again, I know why she made Chakotay the first officer. It was a very symbolic gesture, and he's certainly a person that she can trust. I think everybody who trusts Chakotay, legitimately, he is going to earn and keep that trust, but he is otherwise not maybe the best first officer. I don't know if he would make a good captain.
Yeah, I don't know either, and I think that one of the things that I always wonder is sort of, you know, okay, so you look at this and you say, well, Chakotay was the captain of this Maquis ship. He had this crew behind him. He had Tuvok. He had Seska. He had B'Elanna Torres.
Yeah.
He had some other Maquis that are various extras.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just thinking about something. Seska says at one point, he's like, well, you know, all the information. And Seska's like, the information you have wasn't really important or interesting enough, right? What if Chakotay's ship was a decoy ship, for example? Like, what if he just had a... Chakotay was somebody that the Maquis sent off to distract from real mission.
It's possible.
I mean, maybe that's like... You know, because suddenly, like, I am... This is my headcanon. He's just this perpetual
They give him one person who's actually really good and talented, Torres, and then the rest of them are just sort of, like, secret agents or incompetent.
And maybe Torres is competent but pissed off the wrong person.
It's possible, yeah. I don't know, because I think that, I mean, for me, Chakotay is... Yeah, you're right. I don't think he's a very good first officer. I don't know that he's the best choice.
Yeah.
And I wonder why Janeway would keep him. I mean, I kind of think that there's a little bit of this which is a little unbelievable.
Yeah.
Then again, it was frankly unbelievable that no one ever threw Quark in jail for 20 years. So just kind of have to align that kind of thing. Voyager was not the only Star Trek show to do that kind of stuff. I mean, Chakotay is there because he's a main character and that's what we have to go with. But you know, I look at this and I say, I don't know that she would really trust him very much. I mean, he hasn't done anything that's been untrustworthy, but he's shown himself to not be very good at judging people, which is something that you need to be when you are a captain. And to have someone, not to mention the fact that we haven't even really mentioned yet, except for your comment about her, you know, his girlfriend or her boyfriend, that, you know, apparently Seska and he had a thing at some point.
Yeah.
So this is someone that was very close to him. Now, of course, you know, you can sort of say, okay, well, Janeway would say Cardassian Obsidian Order agents are very well trained to be extremely convincing, whatever, right?
Yeah.
I can't blame him for falling for that because we've seen so many other, you know, Federation citizens that have fallen for this. Okay, you can certainly hand wave that away. But at the same time, I think that it would raise doubts in her head, at least.
Oh, yeah. That, again, I could see her making the decision in early days when, all right, well, we're probably going to be a few weeks at home, so putting Chakotay as the first officer assuages the Maquis people. It makes them, you know, realize that they do have a voice and it's working fine, and it is respect for somebody who was the captain of a ship. And we'll be home before it really makes any issues, but now the damage has been done.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right.
Again, we see, especially at the conversation between Tuvok and Janeway in the last episode, he's her first officer. Chakotay just has the title.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And you know, I wonder too, because I don't know that, I mean, it colors Seska's actions in Prime Factors in a different light, of course, because maybe one of the reasons why she made this, frankly, just unbelievably bad idea deal with the Kazon had to do with the fact that the non-risky plan didn't work. And so, you know, you look at this and you say, okay, well, she had this idea to give technology to the Kazon and do what with it? Make an ally? Okay.
I think she is, it's possible that she is genuine when she says, we have nobody, we have no friends, we need everything we can get. Here's a very easy way to get at least this Kazon ship on their side. And frankly, what are we giving them? A replicator? It's not as harmless as the literature, for example, as the next episode makes clear. Replicator technology and transporter technology are fairly similar, and
terrifying, apparently.
Well, given the ways the holodeck apparently can be weaponized and can be dangerous, certainly I can see if the Kazon put their best Kazon scientists to the problem, they would be able to weaponize a replicator if they wanted to.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I think that
I mean, of course, Janeway makes the point, which is you never know. We have no idea how this could affect the balance of power. And frankly, this is my decision to make.
Yeah, I mean, that is, in effect, the Federation line. And that is Janeway's line. But I do wonder about Seska's motivations here because, you know, okay, well, she didn't want to be stuck in the Delta Quadrant. Of course, no one there wants to be stuck in the Delta Quadrant. So she's going to make this secret deal with the Kazon Nistrum to give them a replicator. So, okay, they're going to be happy. They're going to have someone on the inside on Voyager who is providing them with various levels of Federation technology. They're getting a somewhat steady supply of Federation technology, whatever it may be. Eventually, they'd probably want to move up to weapons.
Yeah.
Seska would happily give them weapons because what the fuck does she care? And what, though? Because,
well, listen, we were on this planet last week, and they had this thing that could travel, you know, you through the entire galaxy, and they weren't really willing to give it to us. Here's replicator technology. Would you mind going on a mission with us to steal a ship from them? I mean, it could even be something like that.
But how is she going to convince Janeway of that? I mean, that's the one part of it that never really makes a lot of sense to me. It's like, what's the end game here? I mean, I certainly get that. Because for someone that is as intelligent and capable as Seska appears to be, I don't know what the end result of her plan is. And maybe that's the point. Maybe it's just supposed to show how desperate she is. I don't know.
Well, that's the mushroom thing at the very beginning. She does this very obvious plan that she knows she's going to get immediately caught for. And she thinks that, okay, well, Chakotay is going to enjoy the soup so much that it doesn't really matter if it was the wrong thing to do. He's not going to really care because she wouldn't really care. And so I think there is a degree to which we made a deal with the Kazon and they got us a transporter platform that is going to take us to Earth. You know, let's all hop on. Janeway would say, well, that's, again, she thinks that, I think about the Federation reaction to Section 31 poisoning the Dominion, which is basically Sisko and everybody aside. Well, this gets us our goal and it's such a wrong thing to do that, but it doesn't really matter. It's done already, and so we might as well take the advantage of something someone else did. Again, Seska would have that reaction. There is a bit of a naivety on her part, too, a bit of short-sightedness, where she doesn't realize that people who are in the Federation won't make that decision. That's one of the things she rails against Janeway for her action in the pilot, destroying the thing that would get her home. No Cardassian would do that. No Maquis would do that.
Yeah, no Maquis would do that. And also, I mean, I've gone on record as saying I don't know if that was the right decision.
Yeah.
You know, I still struggle with that about Voyager in general, whether or not it was actually right to do that. And I do think that Seska's parting line about, you know, Janeway being a fool is, you know, that is obviously combative, and that is obviously designed to be offensive.
Yeah.
I don't think Janeway is a fool, but I can see how someone would think that.
Yeah.
Because that really does lay bare, I think, how different the Cardassian and Federation philosophies are.
I mean, again, I don't think Janeway's the fool. She wasn't close enough to Seska to get fooled by her, but Chakotay is.
Yeah, Chakotay is. And I mean, I also think that in terms of, you know, Janeway being a fool, I mean, Seska's obviously saying that because she thinks that if this was a Cardassian ship, they would be back already.
And I mean, she's a villainess who's being defeated. Of course, she's going to call them a fool.
And she's probably right. Yeah. I don't know. But it is the kind of case where I wonder about how long Janeway can make these unilateral decisions without non-secret agent Cardassians also getting pissed off at her. Because, of course, it's already happened once last week.
Yeah.
Maybe she's put a nip in that particular bud. I don't know. We're just going to have to find out. But things don't seem very happy on the jolly old ship Voyager right now.
Well, I guess my wonder is if we will see Seska again. I kind of hope we do.
We do.
Okay.
The last thing I want to talk about before we move on to Heroes and Demons is the second appearance of the Kazon. You kind of called them Klingons in their first appearance.
They still are Klingons.
Yeah, I don't know that it's like the one. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a weak point. I think that the show does an okay job at making the Kazon out to be not Klingons. And of course, this is only their second appearance. I don't know that we know a lot about them still.
They come off almost like original series Klingons a bit, in that they are the antagonist, and we don't know a ton about them other than some distinctive looks and the fact that they keep reappearing. But that's about where we're at. I have no idea if the Kazon will be treated more in depth.
Yeah, yeah. And also, their headdress was made out of dog toys.
Oh, I love dogs.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I think that probably it's been the finest Janeway scene so far when she's facing down.
Oh, get off my shit.
In the sick bay. And then also once again over the view screen. I mean, she is.
No, she could be. She is a terrifying science geek.
Yes, she is.
I find that I have the phrase holodeck episode, the phrase Voyager holodeck episode, I have an instinctual reaction against it. I feel like this is a good instinct.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about Heroes and Demons then, if we're done talking about State of Flux.
Okay, well, here we have an entirely new quadrant of the galaxy, new species, new things to find, a group of people who are alone in a very hostile part of the galaxy, far from home, no way to get there, a group of very interesting characters that we could have very deep stories about that we can learn about, and we're going to redo Beowulf.
Yeah, I hate this episode a lot.
The closest thing to redemption is that I think the Doctor is my favorite character on the show so far. And since it is a Doctor episode, since we do get some very nice characterization of the Doctor in this, it makes it not a horrible episode. But anything that is not the Doctor is terrible.
Yeah, it's not great. And I always struggle with why it's not great. And I think the primary reason why it's not great is that I ask you a very particular question.
Yeah.
Aside from the Doctor and maybe Janeway, could you take any of the dialogue in this episode that any other character says at any point that is not a holodeck character and give it to someone else and make it sound not wrong? Like, I think it's very interchangeable.
Oh, I'm going to be honest. I don't really remember anything anybody else said. I mean, they literally take half the cast off of the episode. I think Paris has like two lines that's all, gee, we could fix this, or what about the thing?
Well, that's I'm glad you mentioned Paris, because I think that's a perfect example of the lack of knowledge of what the hell he's supposed to be on this show, because he is the pilot. Why is he down in engineering doing engineering science work? He's not a scientist.
Is it just
he's not an engineer?
Yeah, but to be fair, B'Elanna and Harry Kim have been taken by the jellyfish.
So what?
But yeah.
I mean, like, if
no, I know.
I don't know, if you were kidnapped, I wouldn't go hang around at the Portland police office chasing down leads, because I would just get in the way. Like, I just feel like he's there because he's there.
Yeah, because
he's the main character and he needs something to do. I don't know why he needs anything to do. Like, I would rather have seen a random engineering or blue shirt down there helping them out rather than have it be Paris, because, and maybe part of it is the fact of how Voyager's characterization generally goes in the future.
Mm.
But I just really, I'm bewildered at how badly they use him in this episode. I fundamentally do not understand what he's doing there or why he's there.
I mean, I'm going to be honest. It makes a little more sense for Paris to have been the one playing Beowulf and the one being, why did you make that? And then Harry Kim will be in engineering because he does no engineering shit. Yeah. That would have made, you know,
would have been perfect.
It feels like, well, oh, gee, it's been a while since we had a Paris episode. Oh, do we have any coming? No. All right. Well, let's give him a few lines in the Beowulf one. We'll have him suggest the doctor. I mean, it would make much more sense, for example, for Kes to suggest the doctor. She's the one who's close to him. She's the one who regards him.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, okay, whatever. I mean, Paris did spend some time with the doctor early on.
No,
so
and
that's fine.
Paris is a fine. He's a nice guy.
He's like a floater. They don't know what to do with him. And I think it would be fine if he actually was a floater and he just kind of did stuff. Whatever they needed, he was there. He's like a temp.
Yeah.
But he's not. He's supposed to be the chief navigator. What is he doing?
He's Sulu, basically, right? Like,
yeah.
And they found things for Sulu to do.
Right. Well, I guess they kind of did. I don't know.
Well, within the confines of the original series, and maybe this is the reason that I get much more of an original series feel from this series, because they don't necessarily know what to do with their secondary cast.
Right. I don't think they do, and that's kind of a problem, especially since the show has the largest cast of any Star Trek show, which maybe is also a problem. I don't know.
No, it seems like this is one where you could make Harry Kim a secondary character, make him an O'Brien and TNG level character, cut Paris, and...
Well, it's strange to me, though, right? Because I look at an episode like this, and I think the episodes that focus on main characters are quite good. Like, I don't really have a problem with any of them. I think that the episodes that are about a main character, feature a main character prominently, that main character usually comes off pretty well and interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, while I don't think Emanations was like the greatest episode of Star Trek ever, I thought it was decent. And I think Harry Kim comes across okay. And I think we learned some stuff about Harry Kim. Same thing with Paris and like Ex Post Facto. I think that's a fine episode. Is it the best episode of Star Trek ever? No, but we find some stuff out about Paris and he's relatively entertaining and consistent throughout that episode. I don't know what any of the secondary characters in this episode were even really doing.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, part of it, of course, is when I mentioned that Niran Shakar wrote this episode. And, you know, he did write this episode without having seen an episode of the show. Really, they had no information about the characters, who they were, what they were doing. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, okay, but you at least knew that Paris was the chief navigator. So why do you have him in engineering doing engineering work? I just don't, because everybody in Star Trek should know how to do it.
Yeah.
But he wasn't in Starfleet. So why would he know how to do this?
I mean, I'm vaguely remembering an episode where Uhura's fixing something and just like, yeah, I studied this in the academy, but it's been so long, you know, but it's vaguely related to what I do. Like that, you know, we could give Paris something like that, but.
Yeah, he just, I mean, again, I just think he would get away. But anyway, I don't know. I guess I feel like I also don't like the Beowulf stuff at all.
No,
it's
Beowulf. It's Star Trek doing Beowulf. It's not as bad as Star Trek doing Robin Hood, but it's Star Trek doing Beowulf.
Like, who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like, I remember it taking up a lot more screen time than it actually does, and I was pleasantly surprised that it actually doesn't take up that much screen time. I think the last time I did a rewatch of Voyager, I think in 2014, the summer of 2014. So we're talking about, you know, almost 3 years ago at this point. And obviously it was very early on in my rewatch as well, because it's an early first season episode. And, you know, I was pleasantly surprised to see that there were large portions of the episode where they go back to Voyager and they're doing their stuff, and it's not Beowulf, because the Beowulf stuff is competently done. I think all of the direction is fine. The set they made with the forest is great. The actress who plays Freya is fine. All of the actors are fine. The costumes are fine. But it's just like, I don't care about any of this.
And I mean, to a degree, the episode doesn't entirely care. It knows that all of this is a metaphor for what's really going on in a way. This is the, you know, it's not really Grendel. It's some kind of anomaly, and they figure out what it is. The only part of the plot that they really, that anybody completely cares about is the Doctor having this romance with Freya, which again, I think is more about the Doctor. I think much of like I said, I like the sections with the Doctor in the holodeck, because those are all ways of developing and enhancing his character, his reaction to everything, his position in the crew.
No, I will say I think that the one good thing about
it,
the one good thing about the episode is that the Doctor is we learn a lot about the Doctor. Janeway seems to be coming around to the Doctor. He gets a name. Schweitzer, ha ha ha, you know, and then he says, I don't want to have that name anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know? I mean, I think it's significant in picking that particular name. You know, they are very much giving the Doctor a, you know, respect and reverence for life kind of a personality, especially at one point he says, you know, I do no harm and all of that. He is taking the sacredness of life aspect of the medical profession very seriously. And I think it is interesting that a holographic program seems to value that above all else. That is a very poignant statement the episode is making with him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, of course, it doesn't fall into the trap of, like, one thing I like about Star Trek in general is it doesn't fall into the trap of AIs being, you know, horrible killing monsters that just want to destroy all people, which never made any sense to me.
No.
And I like that. I mean, I think that the Beowulf stuff in the episode is not very interesting, but the Doctor is fun to watch. And I think that he is becoming probably one of the standout characters of the show so far. I mean, his performance is very good. He's funny. He's interesting to watch. He's got a point of view. You know, I think part of the problem with, like, Paris, for instance, is I don't know what his point of view is. You know, I could say, okay, I know what Janeway's point of view is. I know what Kes's point of view is. I know what Neelix's point of view is to some degree. I don't know what Paris's point of view is. I don't know what Kim's point of view is. And I don't know what Chakotay's point of view is, honestly. Tuvok, yes, okay.
And I think the three of them, Chakotay, Paris, Kim, have a very common naivety about them. Again, there's a very G-ness to all of them, I would say.
Well, I actually like, I mean, one of the things I like about this episode is when Tuvok and Chakotay go into the holodeck and they're engaging in their little mystery investigation for the first 5 minutes of the episode until they disappear. I think that the show is able to imbue Chakotay with some of that spirit of investigation, some of that spirit of respecting cultures. You know, he talks about how many different cultures have stories like Beowulf. You know, he talks about demons, Tuvok. They have that nice little exchange where Tuvok says, "Oh, well, there are no stories like this on Vulcan," and Chakotay says, "Well, that's why they're so popular." You know, it's just a little bit of a dig, and I think that part of it feels like those characters have some personality.
I mean, he almost, and I guess that is it is interesting to see the two of them working together when they had obviously worked together a bunch on Maquis operations under false, you know, understanding, and now that they're both on the same side for reals this time. I mean, I think it's significant that the two of them like each other then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that...
I don't think you could take a Vulcan, you know, secretly betraying you as personally as you could take, for example, Seska.
That is very true. I mean, I also don't think that Chakotay and Tuvok were sleeping. sleeping together.
That's true.
Also, I don't know why I keep saying Chakotay like Belana Torres does, but apparently that's my thing now, so I'm just going to keep saying Chakotay.
He reminds me in this episode and in episodes like Emanation, I'm getting some Counselor Troy vibes in that she would be the one to explain the culture. I mean, he's able to read the culture around
him
in a lot of ways.
Well, kind of in a similar way, I guess, to how, I mean, who would really function as that in DS9? Maybe Dax? I don't know. I don't know that you really had that character in DS9.
Yeah. The different character. Well, in DS9, it was more of a case as the characters would be ambassadors for their own cultures in a lot of ways. In other words, we didn't have somebody explaining to us what a Ferengi was. We had Quark explaining to us. We had Garak explaining. And also, DS9 was interested in a much more nuanced portrayal. In other words, there is no a character talking about, well, this is what Cardassians are. Is only going to be so right because every Cardassian defines Cardassianism as whatever I define it as.
Which I think is, I think that's right, but I also think that
it can be followed.
Yeah, but I think it also undercuts a problem with Chakotay's character, which is that he should be able to define what his own culture is very, very succinctly. Then. And I don't
but
feel
the,
like
the writers do not, again, right, the writers seem to think that Native American is a nationality.
Yeah, yeah, which, you know, okay, I guess in a world where each culture on the planet is exactly the same makes a little bit of sense perhaps, but anyway. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know. I think that I also wonder about the, I mean, I'm starting to point out plot holes, which means it's never a good episode because we don't care about plot holes if the episode is good, but why is this Polaric energy creature being only going and taking people from the holodeck? They never explain that. It doesn't really make any sense why that would be the case.
No.
I understand why, because you can't have people being kidnapped from the ship willy-nilly, and so they have to have an episode structured to hang this thing on, but
I mean, I gotta be honest, any time that this episode deals with something that involves flashing lights, I tune it all out because I know it's not going to mean anything. It's just gonna mean it's a widget to fit whatever hole the episode needs it to be. Like, already I think that is in some ways a failure of writing, because we should be delighted by this new life form, right? This is in the conversation at the end, Janeway and the Doctor, and you know, talking about this is one of the exciting parts of it, you know, where you get to see something completely different. We could find out what's the same, what's different about that, you know, that we should have these moments. I'm thinking of the tiny light creatures in TNG, or the crystalline entity, or so many. We have seen so many weird, bizarre aliens, and this is not one of them. This is not, I am not going to remember this creature in a week.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to some degree, I think that's true. You know, I don't think that they can all be winners.
No, and that's, I that's certainly the case, and I'm filing this under another thing in the cons thing for this episode.
I guess you could argue that, I mean, I guess I will argue, I won't use the subjunctive there, is that I don't think that the creature is really the point of the episode in the same way that it would have been in like a TNG episode. And so the point of this episode is really to define the Doctor's personality a little more, to get him out of sick bay, to let him develop as a person a little bit. And I think also, frankly, to develop the relationship between him and Cass a little bit. I
mean,
I do like the pep talk that she gives him very much. And now that you brought up a couple weeks ago about how Cass is sort of a Mary Sue character, I can't get that out of my head because she's like perfect. I mean, she's basically going in and telling the Doctor he's wonderful and giving him a back rub and chocolate soup. I mean, it's
she tells him knows exactly what he wants to hear. She is very firm but loving to him, and you know, doesn't give him the option, but you know, makes him be better. She's mom, you know, she's the team mom in some ways, I guess.
Yeah, which I guess, you know, I guess,
or the kooky aunt maybe.
Well, I don't think she's old enough to be an aunt, but
she's old enough to be a mother. You can, if you're old enough to be your mom, you're old
enough
to be an
aunt. She's not old enough to be a mother, which you will find out in a later episode of Voyager.
But wait a second, like, you could be like 5 and be somebody's aunt.
I'm tired of talking about this. No, aside from all that, though, I think that at the end of the day, It's not a very good episode. I don't find Beowulf very interesting. I don't really like it when Star Trek in general does this sort of low rent community theater.
It reminds me of Wishbone in a lot of ways. That's, I think, where what they were trying to do with this.
It was about the same time. I think I would have liked to have seen this as an episode of Wishbone.
Yes.
Well, maybe the last thing I'll mention before we wrap this episode of the podcast up is, do you think that the Doctor, I mean, he seems to be very affected by this away team mission, yeah, and that makes sense. It's his first time technically on an away mission.
Yeah. I mean, he's been pushed beyond the boundaries of his program simply by being the full-time doctor, and now going on away mission was something that the emergency medical program was never intended to do. And yes, I like that, as Kes points out, well, everybody has to, you know, everybody gets nervous. And hell, Crusher had to learn to go on away missions. Bashir had to learn how to go on away missions. McCoy did. You know, every doctor knows, you know, needs to deal with this kind of a thing. And so, you know, he wants to be treated like every other member of the crew. Well, you got to deal with the sucky and scary bits too. I mean, I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose that's true.
I guess part of me also sees this as part of a developing story in a way. In other words, I would be surprised if the Doctor has to stay confined to sickbay for the run of the series, right? Like, they're going to at some point find a way of getting him off of that, whether it's inventing new technology, whatever. I have no idea, but just because they are going to run out of stories that have to take place into confines, and not every adventure can take place in the holodeck because that's not real.
Right, right.
And so I kind of view this is a stepping stone to real Doctor episodes in a way.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I guess the question is, the whole episode impinges on the idea that this alien can make matter into energy and vice versa. So why can't they just do that for the Doctor?
Yeah. I thought the implication was something like, well, it's, you know, we can do that, but to do it, to make a portable version is to whatever, but
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Like in other words, they have all the things to create matter into energy and energy and stuff within. Oh, in other words, are you saying you want these aliens to make the Doctor real?
Yeah. Why not?
Is he going to be a Pinocchio story? Is this what's going to happen?
No, that is not what happens, but I just wonder why they didn't do that. I don't know.
I don't know, because it's only episode 10. Give a guy a break.
All right, well, I think that's it for this episode of the podcast. If you have any thoughts on either of the Voyager episodes we just talked about, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. You can check out our Patreon, patreon.com/trekaboutshow. Which also supports our other podcast, Tuning In. We are running through the X-Files. We are just releasing our episode in 2 days on the X-Files episodes Lazarus and Young at Heart. And if you give us $5 a month or more, you can listen to all of our special patron episodes. There are 17 of them at this point, if I did my math right. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Trek About Show is our username in all those places. And as always, please leave us an iTunes review for Trek About. It is the best way for new people to find the show.
And next, we like new people.
I could take them or leave them.
It depends. Are they cute? Do they have dirty photos to send us?
Next week, we're going to be talking about the Voyager episodes. Just 2 episodes left in this season.
Oh, my God.
Cathesix, I think. Cathesix? Cathesis? Catheter?
Cathexis.
Catheter.
Cathexis.
What? Cathexis?
Cathexis.
I really wish you would stop saying that.
It sounds... And if you want to send us cathexy pictures, you can do so.
So yeah, we're talking about catheter and faces.